This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Writer Shika Dalmia was coming into prominence right around the same time America's libertarian movement was gaining national steam. Her columns, going back to a stint writing editorials for the Detroit News, were a brisk blend of sharp, witty prose, classic fiscal conservatism, and a broad-minded ethos on social issues. Her work appeared in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, and for a long time at the libertarian website Reason.com, where she worked as a columnist and a senior analyst for 15 years. That relationship has ended rather abruptly. She was let go at Reason this week, an apparent casualty of her criticism of Donald Trump. At this crossroads for conservatives of all stripes, Republican and libertarian, we wanted to talk to Shika Dalmia about what may come next. Shika Dalmia, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me, April.
How do you describe libertarianism in this moment?
It's a difficult question, I suppose. Libertarianism, you know, traditionally has billed itself as neither of the right nor of the left, and in some ways both of the right and of the left. So, you know, the lazy description of libertarianism is it's socially liberal and fiscally conservative. So, you know, free markets on one hand, but then, you know, socially liberal policies on the other hand. But I think it is fair to say that the modern incarnation of the libertarian movement that we see today emerged during the heyday of the Cold War, you know, when socialism was the big threat that this country was facing. You know, this was the post-Barry Goldwater era. So it developed in some ways as a sort of a fusionism with the right. And I think that has inflected libertarianism a whole lot, so that right now what you see is, I think it's sort of tilts a little bit more to the right than it does to the left. This doesn't mean that libertarianism, you know, abandons or turns a blind eye to many of the issues of the left. It doesn't. I mean, it's really good on, for instance, the impact of the war on drugs of, you know, to minorities and especially the black community. You know, it is at the forefront of championing a free movement of people, immigration. So it has issue set. It has an eclectic issue set. But I think fundamentally, you know, in a certain philosophical way, it takes more of an inspiration from the right. And that's reflected in how libertarians themselves have become polarized with the culture war issues. I think to me, that's where it's the clearest. The culture wars have become a big mobilizing thing for libertarians. And they take more of the right side in the culture war than the left's.
As early as 2011, you were writing to point out a certain anti-intellectual bent that was taking shape in the Republican Party and warning that it was going to be a problem. Is it possible to put a finger on the point at which a certain defensiveness about conservative intellectual tradition, as you put it, kind of hardened into an intellectual goofiness that led the Republican Party to part ways with academia and any number of newspapers and other news sources that might have otherwise been influences leading to some rigor?
Yeah. You know, that essay, so much has happened since I wrote that essay, right? And in some ways it was prescient, I suppose, and in some ways it was, you know, didn't see what was going to happen quite at the level that it did. But, you know, in that essay, I suggested that, you know, the moment when conservatives became intellectually defensive was when Dan Quayle was the vice president. And, you know, that very famous moment of his when he told a middle schooler how to spell potato and got it wrong. And the press, the mainstream media, you know, exploded into laughter and pillorying of Dan Quayle. And that made conservatives at that time extremely intellectually defensive. You know, they kind of circled the wagons around him and what have you. And then came Sarah Palin. And, you know, Sarah Palin was the vice presidential running mate of John McCain, who himself was, you know, very, very impressive, stellar guy, you know, both sort of like a statesman, right? I mean, an intellectual, but also a man of action. But then he picked Sarah Palin. And she got pilloried. Now, Sarah Palin had this very, you know, sort of folksy appeal to her. So, and when she started getting pilloried, instead of running away from her, you know, lack of knowledge and her, lack of sort of this intellectual bearings, she embraced them. I mean, Dan Quayle was defensive about, you know, what he had done. Sarah Palin kind of cashed in on, you know, for the want of a better word, her empty-headedness. And that, to me, was sort of an inflection point and paved the way for Donald Trump in many, many ways, because he just took what Sarah Palin was doing to a whole new level. But I think the other part of it, I mean, I do have to say, is that liberals have played a part in it, too. You know, intellectuals haven't really delivered to this country. I mean, they have all kinds of pretensions of, you know, knowing what they are doing and a certain kind of, you know, technocratic conceit, which actually Hayek also warned against, you know, that they know how to like sort of remake society top down. And, you know, Obama was in some way the epitome of it. He carried his intellect on his sleeve and he gave the country Obamacare, which at least in the first 5 years was a complete, made a complete mess of things. And I would argue even now, you know, took the country on a somewhat wrong path when it comes to healthcare. And that just left a very bad taste in the mouth of, sort of the folksy, ordinary working class people who thought they were going to be helped by Obamacare, but were not. And I think that, too, has made them double down against the elites and, the designs of the elites.
So when Donald Trump became the Republican Party's nominee in 2016, when you look at this guy who is sort of the apex of the anti-intellectual trend on the right, a reality TV star and total non-politician, what bothered you about him?
Oh, my God. Where to begin? You know, from my standpoint, Donald Trump, his worst flaw was not that he was just so anti-intellectual, which he was. His worst flaw was from a libertarian standpoint. You know, you couldn't come up with a candidate who was more anti-libertarian, who was by nature an authoritarian, who by nature did not understand the institutions of, you know, liberal democracy. He is a man who glorified state violence, right? I mean, he brought out the military in D.C. to clear out peaceful protesters so that he could have a photo op outside the church. I mean, this man was calling on his fans in his rallies to bash protesters. I mean, protesting is a time-honored tradition in this country. I mean, that's what this country is all about. And he was inviting his fans to beat up protesters. I mean, open call to violence. That is a complete no-no for libertarians. So, you know, this open glorification of state violence and violence as such is what really, really spooked me about Donald Trump. And he was at it right till the end, you know, calling the press the enemy of the people, you know, belittling anybody who stood up to him. He purged every sensible person from the Republican Party who was not kowtowing to him. I mean, the list is kind of endless. He is just a nightmare for libertarians from a libertarian standpoint.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, my guest is Shika Dalmia, a longtime writer and theorist in libertarian circles. You can find her work online at the website The Week. Shika, why do you think that more Republicans and maybe more libertarians didn't sound the alarm about Donald Trump?
So it's a good question. And my own feeling is that libertarianism has got too caught up in the culture wars. Given the culture wars, I think too many libertarians or people who thought they were libertarians, I don't think they're real libertarians, for them, owning the liberals became everything. So, you know, so long as Trump was sticking it to, you know, the Democratic or the liberal establishment, that's literally all they cared about. They were very fed up with the forces of political correctness. And on that part, you know, with some justice, they're extremely upset with what's going on in university campuses, you know, where they see that there's a regime of censorship. You know, the smallest thing you say can be used against you. And so there had been a lot of pent up resentment against that culture of censorious culture of liberalism, you know. And so the fact that Trump came and kind of was fearless in sticking his finger in the eye of this liberal orthodoxy just really excited them. They felt he was going to open up this space for them to say what they want to say that had been closing. So I think that was like a huge part of Donald Trump's appeal. And so it was fine with them, you know, that he burns down the system, you know, burns down all the values that they have been espousing, so long as he was just sticking it to their political enemies.
We'd be remiss if we were talking about this libertarian post-Trump moment if we didn't note what happened with Justin Amash over the past couple of years. He eclipsed many other national figures as a standard bearer for libertarian ideals, but at the same time, he parted with the Republican Party over Donald Trump's impeachment and ultimately stepped away from his congressional seat as he was pondering a run for president, something that he ultimately decided not to pursue. Do you think that Justin Amash might have a future in terms of harnessing some of the disaffectation that libertarians and some Republicans are feeling in this moment?
You know, politically, electorally, I don't know, because even though there are lots of libertarians and even conservatives, and I think liberals too, who are very impressed with Justin Amash, I'm not sure they are concentrated in a district from which he could win, right? So I'm not sure. And, you know, I think that's why he's decided to step out of politics. It's not clear he can actually win again. The bigger issue is if he can harness his brand of libertarian conservatism in some other political fashion. You know, he could be, if he wanted to, be a sort of a new intellectual godfather of a new kind of like a libertarian movement post-Trump that is more interested in shoring up the institutions of checks and balances that this country has, you know, relies on to keep state power and autocracy in check. You know, he was fearless in some ways in going after Trump. I mean, at least more fearless than any other Republican. You know, he was sticking up for all the agencies that were trying to control public corruption. You know, the fact that Donald Trump had his children who were running his businesses on his staff in the White House. I mean, Amash was throwing shade on all of that. So I think he understands how the institutions of this country are supposed to work and the damage that Donald Trump's presidency has done to them. And he has a voice. I mean, he's a very, very, you know, he has the ability to kind of cut to the chase and explain this in very, very principled terms and in terms that libertarians and conservatives can understand. So, I mean, I'm hoping that he's going to become something of a public intellectual and use his voice to shore up the institution so that we don't get another autocrat like Donald Trump. But we'll see. I hope he does that.
Well, I guess this gets us to a pretty central question about the liberty movement and libertarians in this moment. I know what you're saying, that libertarians, you know, do exist in this sphere that they hope is both outside of the Democratic and Republican parties. But there have been a lot of moments when libertarians have pushed the GOP to stay true to fiscal conservative ideals, much in the same way that the progressive wing of the Democratic Party has served as a foil. Do you think that what exists of the libertarian movement is elastic enough to hold the kind of sway over the Republican Party as it has in the past, or maybe find a new different kind of powerful voice for itself in the national electoral scene?
you know, libertarians have never been all that influential in electoral politics, right? I mean, they just haven't been a force, partly because of the structural barriers towards third parties, and partly, you know, it's not the kind of thing that libertarians generally do well. Their influence has always been through the realm of ideas. You know, I think libertarians, when it comes to fiscal issues and economic issues, they've held strong. I mean, they've never given up on those principles. And they have been the only voice under any president, whether Republican or Democrat, who has consistently called out sort of, you know, the government profligacy and spending and, you know, what have you. So, yeah, I mean, they are going to continue to articulate those arguments. I have no doubt about that. The question is what kind of traction they are going to get. And there I am more pessimistic. I mean, I think, you know, the Democratic side was never took debts and deficits seriously. And Republicans, because of Trump, have lost complete street cred on that issue, too, because he was even more profligate than any of the previous Democratic presidents in recent memory. So their Republican constituency that the libertarians had for those kinds of issues, I don't think credibly exists anymore. And so we will see if Republicans, clean up their act. I think it's going to take a while. It's going to take a whole lot of work for them to be taken seriously again on this issue. You know, they will need to bring back the Paul Ryans of the world who had made spending their signature issue. Right now, I don't see anybody in the Republican Party who's willing to run with that mantle. Until somebody does, libertarians are going to be just sort of crying in the wilderness.
Do you still see a place for yourself within the movement?
Knew you were going to ask me that. I don't know. In a way, there is a movement and there's no movement, right? I mean, we're all free to do and write what we want to write, and then we will see, you know, how many people are willing to listen. I have lost my my old platform at Reason Magazine, but I'm going to continue to espouse the ideas that I want to. And, you're referring to my recent ouster from Reason. But, you know, the overwhelming response and support I've got from people actually makes me quite, and libertarians actually, makes me quite hopeful that there is some space for my brand of libertarianism going forward. But we'll see.
Shika Dalmia is a columnist at The Week. Thank you so much for talking with us today. And here's hoping for better things in 2021.
Thank you, April.
As we mentioned earlier, Shika Dalmia's long partnership with Reason.com ended forcibly this week. Quoting from her Facebook post, "My views, I was told, had become too out of step with those of the organization." We reached out to Reason for comment. While we haven't heard back directly, Reason editor-in-chief Catherine Mangu Ward told the Daily Beast, "Dalmia's departure from Reason was a personnel issue, so she would not discuss the details."